Welcome to Real Talk JavaScript, the weekly talk show with advice and insight into the technologies and practices currently being used to build web applications in the real world. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallen, and John Papa talk to industry experts about their experiences writing, deploying, and maintaining web applications in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome back to Real Talk JavaScript. This is episode 53, Getting Real with Serverless. And today our guest is Colby Tresness from Microsoft's Azure Functions team. And I've got my indomitable, amazing, and timelessness host, Ward Bell.
Hello, John.
I just made up a bunch of words there for you.
You did, and I'll try and live up to them.
So speaking of timeless, you've been like hiking and going down the Colorado River and like flying to the moon right lately. I mean, you do a lot. I mean,
well, I try and do anything but work if I can. And so
we all aspire to be you.
Yeah, well, maybe. As you know, we're just getting back from the Labor Day weekend, which is we all know, it's the time when we all hold hands together and remember that it's time for the spring mattress sale. So
it does seem like that in the USA when Labor Day comes around. Yeah. It's like signals the end of summer mattress sale.
Mattress sale.
And so, the inevitable hurricane that comes to Florida where I live.
Yeah, so we're busily throwing Cat 5 hurricanes your way. I was just actually up in Mendocino. If you've never been there, it's one of the most beautiful places on the California coast, scouting locations for my wife's painting. And drinking wine and, you know, just doing what Californians, you all know the Californians do.
Wow. And our topic today, Ward, switching gears a little here, is getting real with serverless. And we brought Colby on today. For those of you who don't know who Colby is a friend of mine. He's a colleague of mine at Microsoft, and he's initially from Syracuse, New York. Graduated from Brown University with a degree in applied mathematics and computer science, and is now product manager on the Azure Functions team. Colby's an avid soccer player, a Game of Thrones addict, and a Syracuse college basketball fan. Welcome, Colby.
Thanks. How's it going, everyone?
It's going good, although I've got to say, being that I grew up in upstate New York, I find it interesting that you are from Syracuse and are a Syracuse fan, but you went to Brown University.
Yes, we don't have many. Well, first of all, Brown sports teams are, well, they try. And it's a lot of fun to go to games, but it's not exactly the focus over there. So I definitely stayed with the affinity that I had growing up with Syracuse.
Yeah, I was actually just back in Albany, New York recently. We had a wedding to go to, and I also got to bring my daughter up to Siena College. She's looking at that college as a possible destination, which is in Albany. It's also my alma mater. So interesting upstate New York connections that we have.
Yeah. It's always fun to watch Syracuse crush Siena.
Yes, pretty much. Yes. So when we're talking about functions here, pretty much anytime I have a question about functions internally at Microsoft, one of the people I go to is Colby. So I invited Colby on because he's just a wealth of knowledge of kind of where things are. And we figured we'd do this episode as like a backup, like take a step back and think, how do we get real with serverless? I mean, everybody's talking about functions and Lambda and all this great stuff that we can do, but why? Like, could you start first of all with what problem is this solving and what exactly is serverless?
Yeah, that's a great question and a really good place to start. So I would say that the answer to what is serverless is a couple things. And it's good to get that definition out first, just so we're kind of all on the same page going forward. And the thing about that is that there are different definitions across, even different companies, different parts of the industry. So I'll give you my definition and then we can kind of work from there. But in general, I think of serverless as a couple things. It is first and foremost, dynamic scale. So you as the application developer are not worrying at all about the infrastructure underneath your code. So you, or actually even not code, which we can talk about later on. But the core idea is you do not worry about provisioning any number of virtual machines or any amounts of infrastructure. Whatever your application load is, our infrastructure at Azure or one of the other cloud providers will handle that scale dynamically for you. So that's kind of the core piece of serverless. Associated with this are a few other really interesting properties, like the fact that this dynamic scale is usually event-driven. It's not based on resource usage. It's based on the actual events and the things that are, you know, triggering different parts of your application. So think of that as an HTTP message, maybe a timer, maybe another part of Azure or some other service. Those are the things that kind of kick off your functions. And then the last piece is that serverless is, in general, it's pay only for what you use. So it's consumption-based, meaning that if you are using no resources and you are not executing any code in the case of functions, you are paying nothing. And if you are using a lot of them, you're paying quite a bit. So that's kind of the core definition. And I think the next part of your question is kind of where do we go from there? Where is the how do people actually use this?
What's the value proposition?
Yeah, what's the value proposition? So when I think about that question, it kind of gets into how the cloud has evolved over time. And with the initial onset of the cloud, it was all about abstraction. And the initial abstraction that we got was the abstraction of physical infrastructure into logical infrastructure. Now, with logical infrastructure, you still have to manage quite a bit yourself. You still have to do security updates. You still have to do patches. You still have to do deployments manually. So we have a lot of services that have developed on top of this infrastructure as a service that kind of abstract even that one level further away from you as the developer. So that brings us to something called platform as a service, which a lot of you might be familiar with. The idea is just a lot of these platform level concerns are abstracted from the developer. Azure has a really strong PaaS offering called App Service, where you can build web apps very, very seamlessly. A good example is the Spectre and Meltdown vulnerability from a little while back. Azure App Service at the time upgraded, I think it was on the order of 500,000 or maybe even up to 1 million virtual machines without any of their customers being impacted by those vulnerabilities. So that's an example of kind of the value prop of this abstraction. And then I would say serverless is kind of one more level of abstraction in that direction. So now you no longer have to worry about any of the platform concerns, and you no longer even have to worry about the scale of your application. So in terms of value proposition, the main thing that I like to think about is this kind of trade-off between productivity and control. As you move kind of down the stack into kind of more infrastructure-y things in Azure and other providers, you get more and more control, but of course you sacrifice a bit of productivity, because as you're spending more time thinking about all of these kind of knobs, you have less time to actually focus on coding, focus on your business application. So that's how we think of serverless. It's kind of the very tip of the spear, the most possible productivity. So it allows you to kind of either prototype or build real applications quite quickly. And then I guess I like to use the term fail fast to figure out if you need something that's kind of deeper on the stack with more fine-grained control.
You know, you said something in passing back there that will interest some people, which is cost. Cost. You noted that
cost may interest a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, some.
It's generally pretty cheap.
It's cheap for, depending on how you use it. So if it's what you were saying is that the serverless thing, you know, if you're not using it, hey, it's really cheap, close to zero. But if you use it a lot, it gets really expensive. And that suggests, therefore, that, you know, as you compare that with, say, if I'm trying to host my application, even a retail site in the cloud, and now I still want scalability that I manage myself because, you know, Black Friday, I want to get a lot of people, and the rest of the time, maybe I don't. But that's not the right place for serverless, right? Because I do expect to have a lot of usage there pretty much a lot of the time. Otherwise, I'm out of business, right? So something tells me that serverless is really for certain kinds of functionality, maybe even a subdomain of my application. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's really well put. It makes a lot of sense for any application that has some kind of variable load. So any application where maybe it's a portion of your application that doesn't get hit by every single user, like, I don't know, some piece of your website maybe that only is accessed by a subset of your users, or whether it's, I don't know, some line of business application that you, some piece of work that needs to happen every so often, or something that doesn't need resources provisioned all the time is an absolutely perfect fit for this serverless model.
So I want to interrupt for a second because I feel like I don't agree with something, and I want you to help me course correct me here because you're the expert. I feel like, and maybe we just need to put this in context, that everything we're saying about for variable loads and for the cost and it being expensive if you use it too much and obviously free if you don't use it at all, that really applies obviously to the consumption or the use what you pay for what you use. So before I go any further, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So if we start there with many serverless models, you can say, let me do a consumption plan. Those are my words, because that's what we use with Azure Functions, where you can basically pay for what you have. But what about, like, let's say I build a Node Express API and I know this thing's going to be heavily used. If I move that to one of these, that's going to be heavily used. The consumption plan may not be ideal. I guess that's question one. And then if it's not ideal, is there like an always on option?
Yeah, where would I go? Where would I go if I had?
Yeah. And before you answer that, Colby, let's take a quick break from a word from our sponsors. Hey, Ward, guess what time it is?
I don't know, John. What time is it?
It's time to talk about data in web apps and AG Grid.
AG Grid. I've got a story for you.
Do tell.
Well, it's about my own consulting company, IdeaBlade, where we build web apps for enterprise clients, and they tend to have lots of data grids and lots of complex data grids. Last year, one of our clients said, we want you to use AG Grid. So we said, okay, let's give it a try. And it turned out great.
So you must have had a lot of requirements and features. How did you go through that process?
Well, John, these enterprise apps are very data intensive and they want lots of features. We needed all the bells and whistles, column filtering, column sorting, moving the columns around, custom components inside the data cells, and even grids within grids. And it just worked fine with AG Grid. Just great, actually.
Okay, but the ultimate terminator is going to be performance. How fast was this with a lot of rows?
We had initial worries about that too, but it scrolls so smoothly through that data when you're getting it remotely. It was fantastic.
Would you do this again? Would you recommend it?
Well, we certainly would. In fact, my business partner, who is the lead on the team that built this project, he tells me now, despite the fact that he'd been using another grid all this time, if somebody asks me today to recommend a data grid, I recommend AG Grid. And coming from him, a real curmudgeon, that is high praise indeed.
So everybody out there, do check out AG Grid at their website, ag-grid.com. And we're back. And I left you on a cliffhanger, Colby. Go ahead and answer.
Yeah. So I would say that the first thing is, yes, I'll cut to the punchline that there are other options for hosting your applications with Azure Functions. So this actually gets into kind of some a core piece of what Functions is and how it's actually slightly different than serverless. So let me explain that because it does get...
Yeah, because Functions and serverless are different?
Functions and serverless are different, exactly. You can have serverless functions, you can have functions without serverless, and you can have serverless without functions. So let's get into that. It's lots of stuff.
Yeah, let's walk us through that, please. Yeah.
So Azure Functions as a product is two things. It is the hosting model and it is the programming model. So the hosting model is one of a few things. You can choose to host your code in one of three plans right now. There's the consumption plan, which is your classic serverless option. That's all the stuff that we've been talking about thus far and probably what we'll focus on today, I imagine. But it is good to mention that there are two other options. There's also an app service plan. So with the app service plan, you're paying for the, I mentioned app service earlier. It's actually the same kind of model where you're paying for those dedicated resources, and then you run your functions on those dedicated resources. So in this case, you are choosing the scale you're running your application on. You still only run the functions when they need to be executed. So you still get the functions programming model of running your code as just a function, but you are not scaling that application dynamically. You are running it on dedicated infrastructure. And now the third option that I feel obliged to mention is that we're introducing something we call the premium SKU as well. So the premium plan is another option that kind of gives you the best of both worlds of the dedicated and the consumption plan. The idea here is that you will have one or a few dedicated instances always available. And then on top of that, it will scale dynamically. So what that means, and I know this is a topic that we want to get to at some point, but we would What that means is that if you have that dedicated infrastructure always there, you will not get cold starts. So that is a whole can of worms that I don't want to open just yet. But
yeah, we'll talk about cold start in just a minute because that keeps coming up anytime you get deep into functions. But let me make sure I understood you.
Yes.
Consumption plan basically is you pay for nothing if you do nothing, and you only pay for when you actually have your API or your functions actually being used, right?
Yes.
So that seems ideal for, you know, periodic or not consistent loads, inconsistent loads.
Yes.
Then you've got dedicated and you've got premium, and they both seem to me like the dedicated seems like you've got a machine. It's just a server and you can run your functions on it, but you're not paying for the functions, you're paying for the server, right?
Yes. That's a really good way of phrasing it.
And then
functions, because you made a really interesting distinction back there. Functions is a execution model. That can run, that could be hosted in any of these other ways. But I might very much like the way in which, so functions are often triggered by an event. They fire, you know, that thing goes and runs when some identifiable event that the cloud is watching for happens, and that's what kicks it off. And that's kind of the programming execution model. Have I got that part right?
Yeah, I think so. And I would say that that is actually something that we see people wanting to do distinct from the hosting model. So we mentioned, you asked me earlier, the phrasing of your question earlier about what is the value prop of serverless was something that so I answered that question, but what I did not answer was what is the value prop of Azure Functions? They are slightly different. When you're talking about functions, you get also the program model. And with that, a lot of people like the idea of structuring their code in these small units. Building your applications in an event-driven architecture leads to a lot of nice properties, just like it kind of naturally caters itself to a microservices architecture kind of thing. So there are reasons to use functions distinct from the hosting model as well.
And this is really interesting to me because I hadn't thought about it this way before, but like I understand the consumption model, pay for what you use, dedicated app service, it's a server. But the third model, the premium plan, it took me a while to kind of get my arms around this. And I don't know if I actually entirely understood it. Maybe I still don't until now when you just talked about it. Because the premium plan, I'm like, all right, it's this hybrid in between those two. I'm like, how can you have dedicated but also consumption? But the way you were talking about it, it made me flip this in my head. If I have an application where I want to pay for consumption plan because it feels like that would be cheaper because I'm only paying for what I use, but I don't necessarily want to get the dedicated app service because it could be $100, $200. Who knows what size server I need, you know? And I don't want to pay that every month. I want something in between that helps me get a little bit of a dedication so I don't get this cold start thing, which we're going to have to talk about next.
Yes, of course.
But I also don't have to pay for, you know, a fixed cost every month that's really big. Is that kind of where that premium plan falls in?
I would say so. I do want to say that there are the scale is one piece of the premium plan, but there are also some really nice enterprise grade capabilities that we have with that as well. We have a lot of advanced networking features that you get with the premium plan as well. So it's not.
Can you do like virtual networking and stuff?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. The ability to hook your function into a VNet. There are a whole bunch of different features. I won't go super in depth there, but. Okay. A lot of other things that people like about the premium plan as well. But in terms of the actual hosting model, I think that's a good way to put it. You don't want to pay for, say, 10 instances of your application or 10 servers. You don't want to pay for them all of the time. But you know that 10 can handle your peak load, and you need up to 10 to handle your peak load. So let's say that you have some steady load that is at one or two servers could handle it. So what you can specify with the premium plan is I will pay for only those two all of the time. And then on top of that, pay only for what you use. So it's exactly like you stated. It's a smaller fixed cost for a little more variable cost.
So let me try to relate this to a scenario that I've had many times. And this comes up a lot when we talk about node architectures on this show. This is a JavaScript show. So I've built a lot of node APIs with Express and other kinds of backends. In a lot of the enterprise environments I've had anywhere from 2 to 7 different environments, like development and staging and load and testing and A/B, light and dark and prod, just all these different environments. And one of the problems with a dedicated server to host like Node with Express is if I had 7 environments, that's 7 servers, and they're all, you know, 7 times the cost then that I need to have. Functions seems very interesting to me because if that's an option, maybe I can reduce that cost and also, you know, the footprint of all these different servers, because that's just one app that I was talking about. You know, now I've got 7 environments for 100 apps, and now I got 700 servers, and oh my gosh. Where does Functions fit into this model somewhere? And if it does, how would you recommend it?
Yeah, it's another good question. I would say that the first thing I want to distinguish between is that Azure Functions and some of the other serverless functions as a service, and that phrasing actually is important, so I'll pause there for a second. Serverless functions as a service is probably the best way to describe what Azure Functions or AWS Lambda is. You can have serverless without functions as a service, and you can have functions as a service without serverless. So just to hammer that point home, that's the actual phrase.
Yeah, because we needed another AAS category out there, right? So functions as a service is actually a thing. And I'm, by the way,
for everybody, I did not make it up. I'm sorry.
Now, for everybody listening, I am putting all these links, and we've got like 20 of them already in the show notes. So definitely go check them out.
But anyway, to answer your question, the thing that I mentioned that we do differently than other serverless providers is that Azure Functions has this concept of a function app. And a function app is your logical grouping of functions. So these functions will scale together. These functions will be deployed together. It's kind of your grouping that it's the logical way to think about your functions together. So individual functions map to methods, and function apps map to, you know, services. So in the case you were mentioning about these 7 different parts of one application, I would imagine actually these, if they're built with different models or built, I don't know, it seems like they're pretty distinct pieces of the application. You'd actually probably want these as distinct function apps. That being said, the very interesting thing is that you can actually, so let's say you were to purchase a premium plan, you can actually put multiple different function apps on that plan. So now, again, this is why this starts to get complicated, because there's the level of abstraction of a function app, and then a plan. But you can actually pack multiple plans on a given, or multiple function apps on a given plan, and then pay for that altogether.
So, John, you confused me a little bit.
Good. That was my goal.
Yeah, I know that is often your goal, and you succeeded once again. Let's say I've created this great app for managing funeral services. So something I always wanted to do. I even had a code name for it, which was called Dead Reckoning. So I've got my app called Dead Reckoning, and I want all the funeral homes in America to use it. That's a whole app, right, with all kinds of features. And I'm not – would I ever try and host that in a serverless way? Would that ever make any sense? To deal with the environments thing that you were talking about, spinning up environments and taking them. I always thought apps is like this. Apps are not what I would put in serverless or functions as a service. What I would put in functions as a service is maybe, you know, the billing, you know, so, you know, the charging mechanism or the pricing mechanism or the something that calculates the dimensions of a coffin or something like that.
So the distinction here is that you wouldn't want to. So if I have an Express app that is up and running, I don't know that I would necessarily want to completely put that in a function app and then just run it. That doesn't necessarily fit, because it's kind of taking something that's already working and kind of molding it into this different programming model to do the same thing. Where I would advise using functions is one of two different places, to either extend an existing application or to build a new application. So with the example of an Express server that we have up and running, let's say there are a bunch of different parts of my application. I've built that Express server. It's got all the different API endpoints. I don't want to go touch that again because it's functioning properly, but I do want to add this new, maybe, I don't know, coffin service that you're talking about.
Right. Coffin measurement. How, you know, is John, have I got the right coffin for John?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Have you got the right coffin?
Let's not go there.
So if you want to add this coffin selection service, I would advise, rather than kind of digging through your old code, going into this service that's already working and functioning properly, it makes a lot of sense to me to provision an additional function, because then you can kind of keep this one small bit of functionality scoped at this this kind of separate piece as well. So without touching your existing server, you can kind of stand up an additional API endpoints. Now, the other part I mentioned is building new applications. So you can do things very similar to how you would build an Express server with functions, but I think it has a little less overhead. Again, you're just writing simple if you're in the case of HTTP triggered functions, you're writing simple API endpoints, and each function would map to each endpoint. If you're writing an API, functions is a good way to get started because you can very, very simply map out, these are my endpoints, each of these does a specific thing, and they're kind of fairly self-contained. You can put all of them within this one app, and each function would do a separate piece of work. And this is slightly different than how you would build an Express app, for instance. So two different ways that I think functions make sense, either extending an existing application or building a new application.
Are you calling that second thing building a new application? What does building a new application mean to you in those terms? I'm mystified.
I would say building a new application in terms of, let's say, creating a new API for building the backend for a new application. I think we see a lot of people that are doing this, let's say, two-tier architecture almost. It's a front end, maybe static content even, then with a serverless backend. So you don't need to go through the effort of standing up an entire node server. You can actually just have one or two small bits of code, and then whatever bits of logic need to be processed on the server side, maybe it's authentication, maybe it's some security feature, or even just something that you don't want the client to know about. I think that functions is a really good way to do that because, again, it's a very simple way to stand up an API. And we do see that as a pretty frequent scenario for JavaScript developers.
Like many of our listeners, I tend to be more of a front-end developer than a back-end developer. And so I have a hard time imagining that serverless or something is the best host or best approach for me, but take me to school on this, is the best place for me to spin up my React app or my Vue app or my, the front, all that front end work that I do.
So you probably wouldn't want to host the actual front end with functions.
Although some people do, right?
Some people do. It is possible. And you can do it. We have a feature called Azure Functions proxies that lets you do, it's just a reverse proxy, but the idea is you can actually use, it's a bit of a repurposing of what the feature was initially used for, to actually just serve out front-end content from a function app.
But there's probably better ways to accomplish that, I would imagine.
There are better ways to accomplish it, exactly. I'm just listing the Azure options right now. I can get into some other ones later on. But for Azure, there's the ability to do, you can host static content, for instance, in a storage container. You can also use App Service if you do want to host that front-end content as well. I would say that the functions is more the back-end piece of that.
Right. So it's where I put my pricing engine. I might put a pricing engine there, which has a lot of features, maybe several endpoints and stuff like that. But it's a cohesive, it could be thought of as a back-end app. It's a cohesive piece of services, if you will.
A very simple back-end app. I think it's actually a really good place to get started with writing your own back-end. Our JavaScript functions, just because if you, let's say hypothetically, you're a front-end developer who is just needs to do some small bit of server-side logic. And I think this is, again, why things like Express exist. They make it very simple to make that server. But I would posit that functions is even simpler than that, because you don't need to worry about the server at all. You're just writing one function. You're writing one bit of code that responds to whatever API endpoint you want. Whatever thing that needs to happen on the server side from your client's application, you can call a function to do that logic.
Colby, I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about this thing we keep raising, this elephant in the room, cold starts, and kind of help people understand what those are. But before we do, let's take one more quick break from a word from our sponsors.
Do you want to spend more time building great applications and less time configuring your tools? Do you want a deeper understanding of the Angular platform? The experts from Narwhal can help. Narwhal is a consulting firm
made up of former Angular team members and wonderful web experts who help developers build apps better and faster through their consulting, training, and open source tools. You may be familiar with NX and Angular Console, two of Narwhal's free tools that already help top companies worldwide to build ambitious Angular apps with modern tools and practices. If you want to build software like Google does, consider working with Narwhal. Learn more at nrwl.io/realtalk. That's narwhal.io, real talk.
And we're back. And I got to tell a little story about Cold Start first, my first experience with this with serverless. And this was with Lambda. And then I discovered it again with AWS, with Azure Functions after that. And I took a very simple Node Express app that I had, what I thought was simple, which, you know, the average developer may look at it and go, yeah, but that still had, I'm making this up, 200 meg of Node modules behind the scenes, right? A lot of NPM packages. And I tried to load it up into, turn it into something that I could run inside of AWS Lambda. And then later on, Azure came out after this with Functions, do the same thing there. Now, I took out Express, but I still had other packages that I needed to run. And my first experience with both of them was once I added in NPM packages, these things originally, now this is like 4 or 5 years ago, these things were taking 20 seconds to load, to start. And my instant thought was, I did something wrong. And then I'm like, wait a minute, after the first load, it wasn't 20 seconds, it was like instantaneous to hit my APIs. So let me back up. How did I know this was a problem? I put my functions up there. The function simply just says, go get a list of customers and return them. I hit that API, and the first time I hit the API, the thing is warming up. And it wasn't ready, so it has to get itself ready, and then it returns to customers after 20 seconds. All subsequent calls were super fast. And that's when I started getting into this, well, what does that mean? And I think that's when I think of cold start, that's what I think of, is how long does it take to start this whole process? Is that kind of, am I on the same page with you, first of all, just so we can get people
I think that's exactly right. It's the increase in latency as a result of the fact that our infrastructure is provisioning things behind the scenes for you for that very first request. If you think about the economics of serverless, it doesn't make sense for us to run the service if we have those VMs lying around available all the time.
That's not consumption.
There would be a cost to that. Yeah.
There would be quite a big cost. So what we do behind the scenes and what all serverless providers do is that they allocate and deallocate instances of our infrastructure based on those requests. So that actual first request requires a bit of work. Now we do, I can talk about a lot of the magic things that we do to make it slightly better, but we still are bringing something up to speed, initializing our generic infrastructure to a specific user's code, and then running that code.
You have a nice diagram for that in one of your papers.
Yeah, I wrote a blog post about this a while ago. It's a bit stale. You'll note that there's no mention of the premium plan since that happened since I wrote the blog post, but the content is still super relevant.
Can you pop that into the show notes for folks?
I got it right up there.
Perfect. Thanks, Ward.
Yeah, the diagram kind of shows that process of initialization. It's we behind the scenes will, you know, keep a bunch of instances of functions up and running, ready for customers. And then when that first request comes in, we have to then specialize each of those, whichever function app to the specific user's code. That will take a little bit of time. And then once it's available, you'll have that kind of function app ready and provisioned for you until we detect that it's no longer being used. I think the default timeout right now is, and again, this is a knob in our infrastructure, so it's subject to change, but I believe it's about 20 minutes. So if you've executed a function within the last 20 minutes, you should have warm infrastructure for you.
Now, I was looking at that, you know, 4 or 5 boxes in a diagram of things, and it makes total sense to me. You're taking it from zero to what it is that I actually need to run my thing. I would expect that to be a layered approach like that. I would expect that to be true for anybody. Doesn't everybody who does serverless face the same?
Yeah. And really, it's a problem that a lot of people have done different amounts of work to fix. I would say that the one slight point that I'll make here is that not all cold starts are equal. Now we get compared very harshly to things like AWS Lambda, which frankly has quite fast cold starts on the order of 1 second. Ours are more like somewhere between 2 to 4 seconds, depending on the configuration.
Yeah, let me interrupt you for just a moment, Colby, just to make sure people understand listening to my experience a couple of years ago over the 20 plus seconds. That was in every serverless platform that existed at the time. And these days, I don't know if any of them take that long. I think they've all improved.
We've all done quite a bit of work to to make this much more tenable. But as I was saying, the difference is kind of the way the programming model works. Because functions has the notion of a function app, we actually have fewer cold starts because we reuse the instance of that function app for many invocations of a single function. Compare that to someone like AWS Lambda, where they actually don't recycle any of the containers that they're provisioning with Firecracker, I believe it's called, to run separate invocations. Every invocation gets its own container. So the way to think about Lambda cold start is more, they spin up the first one. Those first couple requests take quite a bit of time. But then since they know you're receiving requests, they really rapidly spin up a bunch of new instances to be available for your subsequent requests. And those will give you that really low latency that you're looking for. With functions, it's again slightly different. Rather than spinning up a ton of containers that are sitting there ready, we've kind of got one instance of this function's host that we've done a good job of initializing. Again, slightly slower than Lambda, but you're prepping that environment for more than a single invocation. So again, it's something that all of the different serverless providers struggle with. Something that we're all investing a lot of effort in. But the one thing I will mention is that it's a bit more of a PR thing than something that, I mean, the purpose of this show is getting real. So if you're building a real application that's seeing any number of users that's not zero, you don't really have to worry about this, right? Because your application's already provisioned. Maybe you'll get a slight cold start when you're scaling out to more infrastructure, but because there's already things that are warm to go to, you'll get definitely lower latency there.
Yeah, let's put a fake scenario on this. Let's say I've got an app and it's got 1,000 users hitting it, and it scales up to a couple different servers behind the scenes because that's what this stuff does. And those hits, let's say 7 of them cause a cold start throughout the process. Is that cold start going to be 2 or 3 seconds, give or take? Is that pretty fair?
So digging into the scenario, are you saying that you're getting all of these requests at once, or are you getting them, you got the first couple, or are you saying those first 7 are coming in and then you're kind of getting the rest through the course of the day?
Good question. Let's say it's 1,000 requests over the course of an hour, ebbing and flowing.
So in that scenario, you would get maybe a couple cold starts right at the beginning, at the onset of the hour, and then after that, you would get no cold starts. I am speaking mostly about Azure Functions right now rather than the other hosting providers because I know most about that infrastructure, of course. For Azure Functions, you will get just 1 or 2 cold starts at the beginning. You might see if you suddenly get a large number of requests at a time, you could potentially see a slight increase in latency, but it wouldn't be a full cold start. And the difference there is the difference between a scale out and a, I guess, 1 to N rather than 0 to 1, because 0 to 1 is quite a bit more expensive than 1 to N, because, again, when you have that one instance available, it's there for you to route requests to while you are provisioning that new infrastructure. The long explanation was really just meant to say you'll get a couple cold starts right at the beginning. That very first request, whatever comes in, that will cause a cold start. And then all subsequent requests, so long as you don't exceed the timeout threshold, which for us is roughly 20 minutes, as long as you don't have a 20-minute gap between your invocations, you won't see any more cold starts.
Yeah, I think the reason I throw this out there is because I agree. Sometimes it's overblown. And here's probably the worst place to show somebody functions or serverless. Get up on stage at a technical conference, crank up a service that only you can get to because it's a demo, and hit it for the first time. And all of a sudden, everything takes a couple of seconds and everyone's like, oh my gosh, it's so slow, right?
Yep, exactly.
But because you're only showing the worst possible scenario for it actually happening. And I think this is why sometimes it gets overblown, because if you are getting this continued throw through there of a couple thousand of these things, you might get a couple meaning 2 or 3 or 4, of these 2 or 3 second delays, latency, but on the other, you know, thousands of them, you're not. Am I blowing smoke or am I?
No, you're totally right. And that was actually going to be one that was what I was going to follow up with, is just like serverless demos really poorly for this result, or yeah, for this reason. Again, you can see pretty quickly the value proposition of dynamic scale, and you can see that you get a lot of benefits from building your applications this way. But there's always the fact that if this is a demo environment, if this is something that you're not actually running in production, odds are you're not getting high load. You're getting just whatever you tested the night before, and then whatever you're doing on stage that day. I feel like serverless gets a lot of bad PR for the cold start factor, but if you're actually building a real world application, we see quite a bit less complaining, as in,
because it doesn't go cold. In the real world, it doesn't go cold. That's really the in a demo, it's cold by definition. In the real world, if it's cold all the time, then you've got bigger you have a design problem, because what the heck are you doing investing in something that doesn't get executed?
There's also scenarios, to be quite frank, like I've done a lot of IoT stuff in my past life, and there's been scenarios with IoT where I could easily see it doesn't matter if it takes 2 seconds or 3 seconds for this occasional thing to get across the wire. All that matters is it actually gets there.
Right. The refrigerator can wait.
Yeah.
Another good example is something like an automation workload. So like, I don't know, cleaning a database or something. That needs to happen, say, once every hour. But it doesn't actually matter if it delays a couple seconds. I guess the takeaway here is that we hear a lot of people complaining about this on Twitter, but not a lot of our actual customers complaining about this.
Yeah, I think it's more just the fear that a lot of us architecture type people have before we get into technologies. If we're going to put our careers and our jobs basically up on the line for technology, you want to know that the choice was good before it's too late. And to get it real here, because I want to leave with a final question to you of some examples of things that actually use Azure Functions and serverless out there, because I know you work with that.
I see IoT as a pretty natural fit for serverless, just because of the intrinsic event-driven nature of the way things work in Internet of Things. I think that's a perfectly valid scenario for serverless, and something that I would definitely advise you to build with Functions or Lambda or one of these other providers.
What kind of scenarios do you see, Colby?
Yeah, so I would say IoT is a great example, but not necessarily the one I see most. Honestly, the thing I see most for at least the Node community is just simple web APIs. As I mentioned, someone wanting to stand up a very simple backend or a new API endpoint for some system they already have to kind of just interface with their front end, to just give some tiny bit of backend logic to their client's application. Other than that, I see a ton of data processing, actually. There's a really big appetite. We also have Functions in Python, of course, so there's a really big appetite for doing kind of the prediction step of machine learning. You wouldn't want to do training in Functions per se, because Functions is much better at IO-bound workloads than it is at compute-bound workloads, because again, many, many, many small events rather than one giant event. So that's a scenario I see people doing quite a bit, maybe transforming some bit of data from going from point A to point B that has some different schema, and you need to kind of do some transformation. Those are a couple examples. I would say that the automation scenario is increasingly important and something that we see quite a bit as well. I did mention the database cleaning example, but there are plenty of examples of starting and stopping a virtual machine in Azure, for instance. If you've got you could call that kind of a bake your own serverless, I guess, if you want to kind of manually go through the effort of building some piece of infrastructure that allocates and deallocates the server yourself.
And Colby, I've mentioned AWS, and so have you, and Azure, because those, I think, are the two we hear about the most with Functions. But put you on the spot for a second. There's other products out there that do serverless type functions out there. Which ones do you feel get talked about a lot?
I would say the main three that I hear are Lambda, Functions, and Google Cloud Functions. So I would say most customers that I'm talking to are choosing between one of those three. There are a couple options as well. There's like OpenFAS is another option that IBM has. And then there's a couple other startups that are doing similar things. Like there's one Binaries has something as well. But I would say that, the majority of people I talk to are either AWS Lambda, Azure Functions, or Google Cloud Functions.
Okay. So we like to end our show with a final tip or final thought that we throw out to our listeners. And I'd like to start with you, Mr. Wardbell.
Yes. Well, I've run into this guy who's actually goes way, 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 way back. He's been in the game longer than I have, James Copeland. But he's like one of the early Scrum people. And what I like is watching him rant about all the things that we hold dear and, or, you know, believe in, like that aren't necessarily so. Like he really rips into TDD. And I've seen him.
Rips as in he doesn't like it?
He thinks it's a disaster and completely unsupported by any science at all. As a matter of fact, my sense is that he thinks that it is at best a waste of time, and it more likely and more often the road to bad results. But his main point is, why do we even believe in this? Where is the science behind any of this stuff? Where's the evidence for it? And he says, there's no evidence for TDD. That's just one of the many things that he goes after. I mean, he thinks that most of what passes for object-oriented programming is, in fact, what he calls class-oriented programming, which is it's lost its sense of the relationship to the business world, and it's all about structuring classes, which wasn't what it was all about. His deepest proposition is that many of these things that become our go-to ideas, we don't even know why we do them anymore. Like he'll ask, he asks his audience, what's a stand-up for? And all they'll do is they'll tell him what happens in a stand-up, what the methods are, but they can't explain why you do a stand-up. So we've lost the why. And the other thing we are doing is busily creating processes that isolate us from getting to understand the business context of the things that we do. We get so lost in technique because we're developers. We'd just rather not talk to the business people or the users. And that's exactly what has, you know, where the agile movement and all that stuff went wrong. Anyway, these are just the beginning of the rants, but I have to say he's such a compelling ranter that I encourage all of our listeners. By the way, he comes after things that I hold dear. Like he went after unit
like Star Wars movies. Because
well, Star Wars, you know, that's why I really like the guy who hates Star Wars. But no, I have no idea what his position on that is. But you know, I like my unit tests, and he goes into a deep rant about what a waste of time unit tests are. Although when you really look behind it a little bit, basically what he's saying is the effort to do 60, 70 or plus code coverage in unit tests is wasted effort. Put your effort in it at integration or system tests. And I believe in that too. You know. But it's got me thinking. So he goes after all of the sacred cows. And yet this is not just some any old ranter. I mean, I've seen him up there against Uncle Bob Martin one-on-one, and Martin is backpedaling like crazy. Right. Bob Martin doesn't backpedal for anybody, but he backpedals for this guy. So, you know, like the whole, you know,
can you pop in a video link to that or something?
I have popped in one. Once you've watched one, you want to see the next one, and you want to see the next one, because I got to tell you, it's upsetting the apple cart in a very important way by somebody who has decades and knows what he's talking about.
You know, disruptors are always a fun thing to listen to. So thanks for that. Colby, what's your final thoughts?
I was the guest about serverless and functions, so I have to say, something about functions and serverless. I would say that my final tip has to be that functions and serverless are not the same thing, and that if you want to, use functions as a service without serverless, there are ways to do that, like the dedicated plan or the premium plan. Well, I guess premium is a little serverless, but there are ways to do that. One thing I didn't mention already is that there's even a way to run Azure Functions with Kubernetes. So that would you would get the event-driven scale of functions with Kubernetes. It's a project we have called KEDA, K-E-D-A. And then
We should do a show just on that topic, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure we could. That one, you'd have to get my my colleague Jeff Holland back on the show to give you all of the information about that. And again, you can run the reverse. You can run serverless without functions. So there are other options in Azure and elsewhere that are serverless as well. One example is Logic Apps. That's a piece of Azure that's kind of more for the integration scenario that lets you. It's a drag and drop designer of connecting different services with a visual workflow designer. So the way I would describe it is if IFTT on steroids is, I think, one of the ways they like to describe it. Again, the core idea there is that if you've got many different services, you can say if email comes in, send to blob storage. If that is configured a certain way, do something else. So all of that is billed based on your actual consumption. So it is serverless. Just one example, but again, there are other things that are serverless and not functions as a service as well. There are even serverless containers in Azure. So
very cool. And I'll end with my favorite tip. This is going to be, and I say it's a favorite tip because there's a gentleman who is just amazing, does a lot of behind the scenes stuff, and quite frankly, doesn't like to take a lot of credit for it. His name is Matt Hernandez, and he works with both Colby and I at Microsoft. And boy, what an amazing, brilliant, and kind soul Matt is, and patient. He is the orchestrator, not the guy who writes it all or the person who writes it all, but he is the orchestrator behind all of the Visual Studio Code Azure-related extensions, especially that I use, at least, like the Azure Functions one. He's also the person who put together a wonderful tutorial for Azure Functions up on the website. And I've got links to both of those inside the show notes, as well as a link to Matt on Twitter. Definitely check him out. Matt does some great work. Give him some kudos on Twitter next time you're using Visual Studio Code and the Azure Functions extension, or you're looking at that tutorial. Go ahead and give a tweet out to Matt and let him know a thank you. And Colby, thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if you're looking to get started in Azure Functions, that extension, the VS Code extension, is definitely the place to start. So really great call out there.
Thank you so much. And Ward, thanks for coming back on, especially after all your amazing summer vacations that you've had.
More to come.
And thank you all for listening to yet another week of Real Talk JavaScript. We'll see you every Tuesday. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk JavaScript. This show and all of our shows are available at www.realtalkjs.com with links and notes. John and Ward would love to hear what you think, especially about potential guests and topics for future shows. Follow and send them a message on Twitter @RealTalkJS.